I'm Doug Nadvornik. This is the Inland Journal podcast for Tuesday, February 26th, 2019. Many Spokane residents live in homes and neighborhoods that were originally built for white people only. Historian Logan Camporeale has found about 40 housing covenants. They were written by developers between 1939 and 1955, and they contained language that sought to limit who could buy and live in the homes they built. The covenants are no longer valid, but the language they contain still resides in the legal documents attached to these homes, and it hasn't been easy to remove it. Camporeale talked about this at a Martin Luther King Jr. Day event last month at Gonzaga University.
During my master's degree program at Eastern Washington University, I had a two-year graduate assistantship at the Washington State Archives, Digital Archives, and Eastern Region Branch. There's a picture of it there. Beautiful building. While I was working there, one of my responsibilities was to fulfill reference requests for researchers seeking to access the collections that we held. One day, we received a call from a researcher, a homeowner, who was interested in putting a new fence in front of her house. She had just recently moved into a new home, and her neighbors had told her that she was not allowed to put in the fence that she wanted due to a restrictive covenant that prevented it. We located the restrictive covenant for the researcher's property, and there was no clauses relating to a fence. However, we discovered something shocking. A clause that prevented people of color from living in the researcher's neighborhood. After seeing the covenant, I immediately began to research how they work and where they are located in Spokane. And well, I guess I should say, I'm a bit of an activist. So I also started to wonder, are these things still on the books? And if so, how can we remove them? But first, let's unpack restrictive covenants and what they do. A covenant is a property document that is often attached to a deed or a plat that sets specific rules that are permanent and run with the land. They are usually for a group of homes, often an entire addition or neighborhood. In Spokane, these documents are filed with the county auditor when they are put in place, and home buyers should be notified of them when they purchase a property. In most cases, the only way to remove covenants is for a majority of property owners to agree to change them. What sorts of things are restricted in these covenants? Temporary structures, nuisances, no detached garages, those are bad. This unique one here specifies the construction of a home must be completed, including painting, within 6 months of the time it begins. So you can't build it yourself unless you can do it real fast, right? You gotta hire a contractor. This one sets a minimum size for the ground floor for homes to be built in the covenant area. And then here's that racially restrictive one that I've shown you before. So how does it work? A statutory warranty deed is the document that is used to transfer property from one person to another. And this is the text. You can see on the top there, I have the edition, High Drive First Edition. So that's one of the editions in Spokane. And then at the bottom there, you can see it says subject to all covenants, conditions, or restrictions. These aren't necessarily filed right next to this statutory warranty deed. They're filed somewhere else in the office. But this is notifying you that if you haven't received these things, you should probably ask the realtor before you buy the home what these things look like and if you can get a copy of them. Good realtors will include them in your closing documents or will tell you about them before you even get to closing. So you saw that one was for High Drive First Edition. This is the text from a Declaration of Protective Covenants. You can see the introduction at the top, which specifies the edition that these covenants apply to. And at the bottom, you can see the racial restriction included in the covenant. I've discovered over 36 editions with racially restrictive covenants in Spokane County. The first was filed in 1939 and the last in 1955. You can see they're all over town, but concentrated in Northwest Spokane, the Audubon neighborhood, and on the South Hill, especially south of 29th. But you can also see them sprinkled out in the valley. There's one there in Millwood and one sort of down near Dishman as well. The locations of those additions with racially restrictive covenants were not an accident. They line up very well with redlining maps created by the Homeowners Loan Corporation. Some of you have probably heard about this. It's a New Deal agency. They created color-coded maps that identified levels of risk and creditworthiness in neighborhoods. The blue and green areas on the map are the most desirable and easiest to insure areas, and the yellow and red areas are deemed less desirable and therefore more risky for lenders. The reasons for neighborhoods being marked red or yellow frequently include notes about a mix of ethnic backgrounds in the neighborhood. Realtors, developers, and other citizens use these maps to maintain racial segregation in their communities. The mechanisms for ensuring segregation were effective in Spokane. This map from 1960 shows the distribution of the Black community of Spokane at that time. On this map, each dot represents 10 Black persons. You can see that the Black community was concentrated in just a few areas, sort of in the downtown area, and then also a little further east near Altamont.
Historian Logan Camporeale then went on to show and mention the names of some of the companies and people responsible for the covenants. They include William H. Coles and William H. Coles Jr., whose family still owns the Spokesman Review. Their names are listed on five of the covenants. Former city councilman Wayne Guthrie, who ran thrice for mayor, is listed on four covenants. In 1948, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled racially restrictive housing covenants could not be enforced.
This ruling, although symbolic, did not provide the means to stop racially restrictive covenants. In fact, nine of the racially restrictive covenants in Spokane were put in place after the Shelley v. Kramer decision. People were willfully disregarding what the Supreme Court had said. It was not until the Fair Housing Act of 1968 that we saw real change. Real change. Passed as a result of the outrage over the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King, who we're here today for, who had called attention to racial inequalities in housing. It was signed into law just a week after King died. The law allowed third-party standing to individuals to pursue claims against illegal enforcement of already unenforceable racially restrictive covenants, even if they were not personally discriminated against. Before we move on to the next section, I want to point out something about the language in Spokane's racially restrictive covenants. In some cities' covenants, specific groups of people are identified in the language. In Seattle's Queen Anne neighborhood, for example, the racial restriction clause reads, and I quote, "No person or person of Asiatic, African, or Negro blood, lineage, or extraction shall be permitted to occupy a portion of said property or any building thereon, except a domestic servant or servants, who may actually and in good faith be employed by white occupants of such premises." So you can see this language is rather specific. It identifies specific groups of people. In Spokane, this sort of language was not used. Just a standard clause, no race other than the white race shall use or occupy any building or lot. Additionally, to restricting Black Spokaneites from these neighborhoods, this clause would have prevented Latinx, Native peoples, Asians, and even Jewish people.
Logan Camporeale has written about the covenants in his blog, and he's talked to city elected officials, neighborhood councils, and reporters. In 2016, Sean Vestal wrote about the covenants in the Spokesman Review. Camporeale also talked with Rick Eichstadt from Gonzaga Law School's Environmental Law and Land Use Clinic. He has assigned, over the last several months, students to research the covenants and remedies for removing them, and that has led to a lawsuit on behalf of a Spokane homeowner. Meanwhile, the Washington legislature last year approved changes to the law that make the process much simpler. We'll hear about those details during the rest of this podcast. About 2 years ago, Spokane native Alex May moved his family back to Spokane after years of living in Seattle. He learned that the South Hill home he wanted to buy included one of the restrictive covenants.
We found out about it as part of the closing process. We had to sign some documents, and that was one of the items, the covenant, the racist covenant was in there. It's one of the items, and our real estate agent kind of said, by the way, you're going to see something in there. It's not legally applicable anymore, but it's just part of the title, and it's there. And so that was surprising to me. You know, I knew about redlining and things like that, but I guess I just didn't really expect to see that in there, that language in there. And then
and so what, how did you feel like when you saw it?
I was shocked, surprised. It kind of just felt crazy that something like that would be, you know, it was 2017, I guess then.
So tell me a little bit about your neighborhood, and was this part of a larger area that has these covenants?
Yeah. Well, as I understand it, we live in the Comstock neighborhood, and it's a number of the houses there do. And then after, so I that kind of prompted me to do some research, and I found some articles locally and some national articles, and realized it was a much broader thing than just that one neighborhood, and including, I can't remember other neighborhoods in Spokane, but I know there are some.
And so did you decide then that you wanted to get this off of your cabinet? What was your thoughts about what your options were?
Yeah, I was curious, and I reached out. I was curious to see if there was some way of removing it or doing something. I didn't really know what the options were, and so I reached out to Logan, and he put me in contact with Rick at the law school.
And Rick Eichstadt assigned law students to work with May. The latest to take up his case is Brad Lyman.
Honestly, under the statutory scheme, it seems pretty straightforward, so I was pretty excited to get something that seemed simple and could have a potentially huge impact if it worked out well.
So tell me about the case from a legal point of view. How do you view it?
So, like he said, those provisions are void under an old... It was originally the Fair Housing Act nationally, and then Washington passed RCW 4962.24, which voids any provision in a real estate contract that seeks to forbid or prohibit the conveyance or occupancy of any property to like a certain class of people because based on race, religion, anything like that. So all those provisions are void, but they still appear there on the title and in the public records. So even though they're void, they're still there. And then Washington passed the RCW 4960.227, which provided a remedy for that, which allows homeowners or a tenant of property subject to such a revision to either... Originally, it was just file an action in court as the owner or tenant saying, this is on my property, and if the court finds that it is void, the law says the court shall enter an order striking the provision from the title and from public records, which means not just like ignoring it, but actually crossing it out. What we think they should do is either cross it out and say there's part of this and we're storing it somewhere else, but it's not on here anymore.
Alex May's case has been filed against Spokane County, but not yet scheduled for court action. There's a lawsuit because the county and auditor Vicki Dalton argue she doesn't have the power to do what Alex May wants her to do.
In state law, I cannot alter a document that's been recorded. So that document needs to remain. It is history. It is what happened.
That's where the dispute is, over the power of the county to remove discriminatory language from residential covenants.
Well, the county auditors have been aware of the restrictive covenants in deeds and plats for years and even decades because they've been around that long. But there was never really a good process to deal with those covenants. There is a court process that's available that was created back in the 1990s. And had only been used a couple of times. And it's essentially requires that the landowner go to court, get a court order, the court order is recorded. It's a very long and expensive process, and that's what's happening right now with the lawsuit that's been filed here in Spokane. Thankfully, last year there was a legislator who saw a need and came forward with a bill that had a few little problems with it. So several stakeholders got together, the county auditors, historians, the title company representative. We got together, we worked on the bill so that it would be an effective and simple process for landowners to use. So that bill went into effect on January 1 of this year. And over here in Spokane, I'm still waiting for my first landowner to come forward and file one of these modification documents.
And so what is, I think you've just made reference to it. What does that new bill allow you to do, or what does it require you to do?
So what the new bill creates is a very specific document called a restrictive covenant modification. And so all the landowner needs to do, or the homeowner needs to do, is to have the reference number of that original plat or deed that contains the offensive racially discriminative covenant in it, reference that number and the date of that particular document. Just it identifies that there is a restrictive covenant that is not enforceable under state or federal law, and then come in and record it, and it is recorded at no charge. So instead of paying $99 to have a one-page document recorded, they will pay no fee whatsoever. So this does not destroy the original document. But with this modification document, the landowner can call out the fact that there is a restrictive covenant in that chain of title and ensure that everyone understands that it is no longer enforceable.
I think there's some desire to just remove that language from, and you're saying we can't do that legally.
Correct. So that is the historical document. So that is the document, whether it's a plat or a deed, that all sales and land ownership and chain of title is based on. It is history. You cannot eliminate, obliterate, or destroy history. That is what happened. But this particular process at least allows, in the modern record, the landowner to say there is an unenforceable restrictive covenant that is no longer in effect.
I think there's a worry there's some residual effect of that. If you don't completely remove that language from that document, then there is some sort of stigma or something that's attached to that land or whatever. What do you think about that?
Well, I don't think there's a stigma attached to the land. I think there's a stigma attached to the conduct of previous generations. But in reality, that was the conduct of previous generations. And we should be aware that that kind of thought pattern and activity was considered normal or acceptable in that age, and realize that people were damaged by that. Let's honor the people who were hurt by this. Let's honor the people who fought against it and got it changed, because now we have both state and federal law that says these racially discriminatory covenants are unenforceable and, in fact, cannot, by law, be brought forward into the modern record in the chain of title. That clause cannot be brought forward into the title company's title report. It cannot be brought forward into the new deed. It must reside and stay in history, not in the modern record.
So aside from the legal questions of what you can do and can't do, it sounds like you're making the case that it's important that these stay, if for no other reason than we're reminded about what happened in those years.
Yes, and I do understand how offensive these clauses are to people and the emotional pain it does cause. But the reality is, this is our history. Whether you're talking about racially discriminatory covenants, whether you're talking about the fact that people were sold into slavery on auction blocks, if you're talking about, you know, any of the many other discriminatory activities that occurred in this nation, including the Japanese internment camps. There are a lot of terrible things that have occurred, but yet one of the things that makes us strong as a nation is that we will face those acts and we will call them for what they are. In this modern age, they are unacceptable.
Dalton argues the lawsuit will have the opposite effect of what the plaintiffs seek, regardless of who wins.
What will happen is we will record that lawsuit, the judgment handed down by the court, and it will be recorded in the modern record, and in all likelihood it will include the offensive clause that will be brought back into the modern record now. Whereas with the other process that thankfully we just finally have implemented, that offensive clause would not be brought back into the modern record. It would just state there is the historical record that contains unenforceable discriminatory covenants, and those cannot be brought forward.
On the other side, law student Brad Lyman thinks the case is worth pursuing.
30,000-foot level, how important is this case in sort of legal doctrine?
I think it's extremely important because it's people will see this. If someone's trying to buy a property and they'll see, oh, this used to, these class people used to not be able to live here, that might throw some people off. And it's really just, it kind of, I call it a badge of past discrimination in this country. It's kind of crazy that we just haven't gotten rid of it. It seems almost like the like historical statutes in the South. People want to have Confederate statutes because it's historical, but I do not agree with that.
So, Alex, you are in essence a guinea pig here. Do you view yourself as that, or how do you view this?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that was one of the things I was surprised about when I reached out, is that no one else had gone down this path, especially if it sounds like, and you guys researched it, there is a pretty, it sounds like a pretty clear legal description of what should happen here. The fact that I guess you guys researchers, no one else had done it, was surprising to me. And so, yeah, I'm happy. I'd be very excited if this was set the groundwork for more people doing this.
And so you want that language out of out of your deed, essentially, right?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I get that it's a historical document, but I think there's better places to capture history than in a living. It is a living legal document, and I can't, like, I'm trying to imagine how I'd feel if I was a minority or person of color trying to buy a house, and that language was just in there, and you know, somebody's like, "Oh yeah, don't worry about that." But I don't. That doesn't strike me as feeling right.
So, Brad, is if you get the ruling that you want, do you consider this an important precedent, or how do you view that?
I think so. It's something that hasn't been done before. I think that the Washington legislature put this statute providing this remedy, and I think it would be pretty cool to see it gone through and actually used like the legislature intended to.
This is attorney Rick Eichstad.
You know, if you had a HR manual, you know, for Gonzaga, and it said, you know, we don't hire, you know, Jewish people. Well, you wouldn't just put a note next to it and say, this is no longer applicable. You would remove it. Frankly, having the court case, I mean, if the county is resistant to actually removing them from the record, if somebody comes without a lawyer trying to do that, it's unclear what the response is going to be. Mm-hmm. So I think having, you know, this first go round, you know, and reaching either agreement with the county or, you know, the judge clarifying what does strike it from the record mean, is going to be important for both the court process as well as for folks who want to do it on their own.
And if you want to do it on your own, Brad Lyman says Gonzaga Law School may be able to help homeowners. Also, the Spokane County Auditor's Office has posted links for PDF versions of restrictive covenant modification documents on its website. We have a link on the Inland Journal page for today's podcast. As far as the court case, Eichstad says both parties in the lawsuit, Alex May and Spokane County, are asking a court for summary judgment, in essence, to declare the case for one side or the other. Either way, he expects an appeal to a higher court. And now a quick look at the Inland Journal mailbag. Last week was the first week of the daily podcast, and we received several notes, a few from people who appreciated the deeper look into issues that our program provides. The one story that drew the most attention was last Thursday's program about electric cars. Tim Bowden from Sandpoint shared that he has driven an electric vehicle for 7 years, and like Jay Berube on our program, he too is looking for what's the next EV that he wants to buy. He writes, "Our car really takes very minimal maintenance. Tires, brakes, and window washer fluid is about it. The one negative to all the green aspects of the car is when the batteries need to be replaced and disposed of. Very toxic. Hopefully, before this needs to be done, there will be some way to recycle them in a good way." And Jorgen Rasmussen thanked us for the program and reminded us he'll be hosting his fourth annual National Drive Electric 2019 event in September in Liberty Lake. We'll mark it on our calendar. Your comments are welcome at inlandjournal@kpbx.org. You can call and leave a voice message on our listener comment line at 509-232-6904. We may use your comment in the podcast. To find and subscribe to the Inland Journal podcast, search for Inland Journal in iTunes, NPR One, or Google Play, or find it on the Inland Journal page at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thank you for listening. I'm Doug Nadvornik.